Welcome to Goals Question Time, where I interview leading executives driving innovation, venturing, and strategic change.
Aim and I have been working with global corporates and startups on what we term innovative new value chains, which are connecting new technologies, ventures, and corporates with new business models in the transport and energy sectors, as electric vehicles will revolutionize many industries. This podcast is one of a series where I speak to leading executives who are making the important transition to sustainable future. We have been working in the UK, Europe, and with programs in leading locations such as in Oslo and China, where there are high penetrations of EVs and massive numbers. Do get in touch if you would like to find out more, and don't forget to subscribe for future podcasts. Thank you.
So, welcome to Goals Question Time. I've got the pleasure of being joined today by David Grunwald, who is Vice President for Innovation at Farfetch, the fashion online retailer. So, hi, David.
Hello. Great to be here.
Thanks very much for joining us, David. Really appreciate you spending your time to share your perspectives. Could you kick off with a brief introduction to yourself first, please?
Yeah, sure. As you said, I look after innovation at Farfetch. We are a global technology platform for luxury. And I've been at the company for a couple of years now, joined after a long stint, 8 years at Google. Prior to that, worked on a bunch of startups in the technology and e-commerce space, did some product management, some consulting. Landed in the world of luxury fashion, as I said, 2 years ago, and it's a fascinating place to be.
Great. And could you describe Farfetch to us, please, in terms of, you know, when it was formed? Because it's now launched in the stock market, but, you know, it's pretty much a startup, and its proposition in the fashion and e-commerce space.
Sure. So Farfetch was founded in 2007, launched soon after that, and that was the depth of the last major recession that we were experiencing. And the company was formed by our CEO, a guy called Jose Neves, who is one of those very rare people on the planet who is both a fashion designer, and he was a boutique curator in London at the time, and a software developer. There aren't many people that combine those skills. And he looked around and saw fashion boutiques losing footfall and struggling to get customers, and wanted to build a web channel. So built an aggregator for independent fashion boutiques to sell their products to a global audience. And as you might expect, being a fashion boutique curator doesn't necessarily mean you have the knowledge or understanding of web channel or the internet. And so Jose was filling a very much needed niche. And the company grew and grew and grew through various rounds of funding, and IPO'd in September 2018 in New York City. We are about 4,000 people strong. We have offices all over the planet, big presence in Europe, obviously, where a lot of the fashion products come from, big presence in the US, and very large growing presence in China as well.
And yours is as a platform. You're not taking the stock and dispatching like, I guess, Amazon or something like that. Can you describe your model in a little bit more, how that sort of works?
Absolutely. So we have approximately 700 independent fashion boutiques on the platform. We also work directly with a number of the major brands, most of the major brands as well. We do not hold stock. We are a facilitator for those fashion boutiques to find customers, and the dispatch is effectively dropship. So product goes out to customers anywhere on the planet, from anywhere on the planet where we have a boutique. And those 700 are very, very good friends of ours. They're partners. They're highly regarded and vetted top fashion curators on the planet. And so if you order a pair of trainers, you can receive them from anywhere on the planet, and you can be anywhere on the planet. The company makes it very easy to happen. So a lot of the smarts is in the logistics, the cross-border, the customs management, and making it as easy and as seamless and therefore as strong a customer experience as possible for the consumers that use the service. About 4 years ago, we launched a white label version of our e-commerce platform under the name Black and White, now known as Farfetch Platform Solutions. And there are a growing number of fashion brands themselves that use that. So we frequently handle their logistics and back office for them as well. But we're certainly powering a number of major fashion players' websites too. Completely behind the scenes, it's totally white label. The business bought one of London's heritage fashion brands, called Browns, in the West End of London, again, about 4 years ago now, maybe 5 years ago. And that is one physical premises that we maintain. In fact, there's two now. We opened up a sandbox, a sort of technology first store in East London called Browns East in Shoreditch, allowing us to test new things out. And we also have a division called Store of the Future, which, as you might expect, is that sort of online to offline physical retail link as well. And that produces some really cool projects, one of which went live earlier this year with Chanel in Paris. We do the in-store technology for their flagship in Rue Cambon in Paris.
So I guess a key challenge in this space is getting the product dispatched from your third-party boutiques. But we know that a large percentage of these types of products end up getting returns. And so you must be experts in managing that back logistics and refunds and reissuing and sort of stuff like that as well. Do you find that a big challenge? And what sort of percentages
It is a challenge. I don't know the exact numbers for Farfetch, but generally in fashion, 40 to 50% of products is returned, certainly in the UK. And it's very, very high, and reverse logistics are something that we've had to get very good at. And we think the answer to that is actually getting customers what they want first and getting it right first time. And so we've put a lot of effort into helping customers to find the right size of product. There's some great technology solutions to that. Also inspiring them to buy the right thing first time. I don't think there are any easy fixes to reverse logistics and returns in the industry as an issue, although... Yeah. I would say that the sorts of purchases people make in luxury, and we're talking about products that are not, you know, this is not high street fashion, this is quite high end, to the very high end. They're generally more considered than people buying five or six dresses from Primark and returning four of them. But the pattern is certainly there. People do return things a fair amount. And there are... There are some fairly clever supply chain and logistics responses to that that are necessary.
Yes, good. Okay, let's move on to your particular role then. In, you know, fashion and retail is changing considerably, and you lead the innovation sort of space. And I guess some of the aspects you just talked about, helping the customer choose the right sort of product, and that what does your innovation cover then within Farfetch?
So the innovation team at Farfetch is we're a small team in the center of the organization. We've got people in a few different places, and we are effectively the idea of the CEO, Jose Neves, who, reflecting on the company's hypergrowth 3-ish years ago, wanted to find a way to ensure the company continued to drive things forward, remain agile, innovate. We do a few different things for the business. I guess the first one is we are a team that has the remit to look outwards at Farfetch. And to do that well, we have to understand the needs of the business inside. So we pair innovation scouts, or principals as we call them, with some of the divisions and functions around Farfetch, and then help them to find things either reactively when we see startups or entrepreneurs talking to us inbound, or more often than not proactively, to match up needs with solutions. And it's an important offer for the company, because it means we're making decisions about what we know versus what we're finding out. And that notion of, in a neutral way, making decisions about whether to partner with something, to buy it, to build it ourselves, is a super important, very core part of the offer. And when it comes to innovation of that kind, we're typically not talking about disruptive long-term projects. We're talking about the short-term needs of the business. But there is something very much about commercial agility as it applies to the business on the day-to-day. And We like to think we offer intelligence about emerging threats to the business as well, allowing Farfetch to react ahead of the curve. And I mean, frankly, the model's proven incredibly successful, but no one is overly relaxed about that, and we're not complacent, and we want to be sure that we're seeing interesting things in the market that we can work with.
Sorry, it's just a really good point you make there, just to re-emphasize, because I work with so many corporates on this sort of innovation outside, and they sort of, I said, well, do you have this open view to listen to the people who are outside? And they often say, oh, yeah, we're strategic. You know, the business unit decides where the innovation sort of happens. And I said, well, that's actually tactical, isn't it? If the business unit has over influence on you, then they don't tend to see these things. They sort of dodge the threat. And they say, doesn't suit our business model. And you're the one that's out there seeing these things, like scout bees, as I describe it, out there seeing the new technology, seeing the new business models, seeing the new ways of interacting with customers. And if the core business then sort of says, oh, well, no, that's not the way we work around here. Now, Farfetch is still quite a young organization, but certainly, larger corporates, they're not open to listening to that. So you feel your colleagues are listening to you now?
They are. I mean, we have to persuade. We have to use as much data as we can. And I think the company has a lot of people that are used to working in agile environments. I mean, it recruited a huge number of people when it was still a fast-growing startup who joined because of that agility. So we're knocking on an open door when it comes to that sort of innovation. We are also, I think there's something very profound about being open to listening to entrepreneurs, because if you are passionate enough to build a company, whether it means quitting a job or making a change in life, an early stage entrepreneur has a hypothesis that's the reason that they are doing what they're doing, and they're often the first indicators of coming consumer trends, because they are frustrated consumers themselves that saw the need. So it's very important philosophically to continue listening to that as well. We also have I guess the next bucket of things that we think about our platform and ecosystem, as I would call it. So Farfetch, I referred to earlier very deliberately as a tech platform. We have an API platform that partners and startups can plug into, whether it's to access the demand that we have, the customers, or potentially some of the supply, or potentially any of the ancillary things. So we work with a game called Dressed. It's not a company that we own, it's a company we partner with, who allow consumers to virtually dress influencers using Farfetch's catalog. Dressed are accessing our catalog API through the platform. So there are ways of really adding value to our customers and our ecosystem through exposing those endpoints. And our team, the innovation team, is at the sort of forefront of helping to find those partners. Farfetch has, we're at the center of the industry. We don't see ourselves as competing. We see ourselves as partnering with the brands and the boutiques we partner with. And we spend a lot of time helping them to understand the secular trends in the industry and the technology opportunities out there. There frequently are very specific partners in innovation initiatives. And I'll talk about Dream Assembly, which is our accelerator, in a moment. And this is something Jose felt very passionately about, and this is one of the things that drew me to the company. We want to give back to the startup ecosystem that we only just recently emerged from. It's very important for us to keep it real in that sense. Farfetch is a product of the European ecosystem. It's a company that has origins in both London and Portugal, where a lot of our team is based. And we take that responsibility very seriously. And that was one of the reasons why this team was founded as well, because we want to help the little guys to go on the same journey that we came from. And we also want to be seen as the partner of choice for fashion tech startups as well, because of the opportunities that are so mutually beneficial. And finally, I think that the remit's about people and ideas and culture. And I said earlier, Farfetch built an innovation team much earlier than many companies in its life cycle. And that is about keeping that original, raw, innovative culture. It's about ensuring that we're capturing ideas, and we have structures to capture ideas from anywhere in the group, wherever they emerge, whatever level of employee. It helps us candidly to build employer brand around the company as well. We have thousands of engineers at the business, and my experience as an ex-engineer and working with engineers, they like seeing the company working on technology and innovative projects, necessarily outside the core. And we also, I feel very strongly that actually being able to offer colleagues, Farfetchers of all kinds, access to tech startups is a win-win, because the startups benefit from mentorship interactions and advice. The employee will inevitably, in my experience, get something out of a mentorship interaction, whether it's understanding a new technology or just developing a soft skill like active listening. So that's really commercial agility, ecosystem and platform, and people and culture are our main reasons for doing what we do. There are three main things, deliverables, if you like. I've spoken about startup scouting already. We've captured a database of a what we think is a good proportion of the best of startups out there in the fashion, technology, and e-commerce space that we maintain, and that's a really useful list and asset that we have. But the other things that we do, we run innovation programs. So we have developed and deliver annually a range of structured program formats for engaging with startups. So there's a startup accelerator called Dream Assembly. We run boot camps with startups as well, and we take partners through design sprints and workshops. These programs are powered by mentors, internal, I've mentioned already, and external practitioners as well. And they're always aligned to the company priorities. So we ran one startup accelerator cohort based on sustainability in fashion, because the industry is a major polluter, and we know it can be better. These programs are often delivered in conjunction with external brand partners as well. So we've worked with Burberry, with Stella McCartney, and a whole host of fashion companies behind the scenes as well to deliver them, and that's a huge value to the startups we work with. I guess scouting and programs, and finally POC development and project development on longer term initiatives as well. So Farfetch has had a long term project on a number of the more foundational areas within fashion technology. So we've talked for a long time and working on projects around, for example, blockchain in luxury and virtual fashion, so 3D products as well. So really that's the long summary of what we're doing.
So could you give us a couple of little stories behind two or three of the ventures that you've been working with then through those sort of programs?
Yeah, of course. I mean, one of them I'll talk about called Second Life, which is a partnership we built with a Hong Kong-based startup that went through our first ever Dream Assembly program. So that was back in the spring, summer of 2008, we met them. And this is a company that is, it provides a buyback program for handbags on the Farfetch website. So this business, they accept 27 different brands of handbag, and really, we did this because it's absolutely core to the circular economy to give people outlets to resell product that they owned and cherished. They can trade those handbags for Farfetch credits and buy something shiny and new, and the bags are sold on in the aftermarket. And that's it's a service that we rely very heavily on that startup partner to deliver. And it's a company we wouldn't have met, and it's a very rare business that can do this at any scale without having run that Dream Assembly program. There's a couple of others as well. Recently, I think this is very now. Recently, we launched a pilot with a company called Wannabuy, who do virtual sneaker try-on. So you can hover your mobile phone over your foot and see one of a range of different shoes in 3D AR. Good quality across a number of brands. And that went live in China in February. And I think that hit the... that launched at a good time, because the country was in lockdown and people wanted new experiences and ways of sampling product. So that's something that didn't come through the Dream Assembly Accelerator, but it came through our scouting network as well. And it's pretty interesting.
Great. Thank you. So moving, thinking about that, as you just touched on China, as we were saying on the pre-call prep for this, I've got about 12 years of experience of working in China with corporates and looking at innovation and seeing how some of the things are done quite differently there and how their how they've applied the technologies. What's your experience of working in China and looking for these innovations and seeing how the market is changing?
So China's a fascinating place. It's a major part of what Farfetch does. We've had a very strong partnership there over a number of years with JD.com, which is one of the two very large Chinese corporations in technology. And it's a highly important market for us. And what's fascinating about China is the consumer trends there are in some ways very far ahead of the West, and in some ways not necessarily ahead, but different and relevant, if not directly so. There's a bit of a shorthand way of thinking about why, at least in my mind, why things are so different there. So why the smartphone is at the center of everything and why social commerce is so well established. And that's because when e-commerce was growing in the US or Europe, the smartphone and the social networks weren't things. There was no mobile infrastructure for commerce. There was no social infrastructure for commerce. Whereas in China, that's flipped because these trends are both the last decade. So the major social networks in China, the WeChats, were very established before the rise of commerce, which is why mini programs and social shopping based around a social infrastructure are very prevalent. It's why, you know, I've been to Shanghai recently and it's very hard to transact in cash in some places. You need a smartphone. And that is why it's so native.
I've had the same experience. Now I've had to walk out of restaurants and stores because I can't pay because I didn't have WeChat Pay or Alipay. You know, so it's not just about contactless and credit cards, which we're used to in the West. You know, I was looking at some of the stats. $41 trillion were transacted on the mobile payments platforms in 2018. You know, it's phenomenal in terms of the percentages and the scale of them compared to the West.
It is, and the value add that the mobile platforms can provide. I mean, that's that social reinforcement, the you know, shopping with influencers or video walkthroughs in store. They are very core experiences to a lot of the luxury retail that we see in China. And it's a huge market for personal shopping as well, using those social platforms. So it's a fascinating market. I'm not sure everything that happens there is readily applicable to the West. It may come, but I don't know if payment using Face ID at point of sale is something that will take off in the West due to privacy. It may, it's really a great market for seeing indications and where things could be on certain fronts in 2 to 3 years' time. And it's one that is always worth watching. It's very invigorating and sometimes slightly confusing traveling to China for technology.
Certainly, I was in China in October and November last year, and one of the things that struck me in November as well was that those in-store influencers and the in-store interaction live on video. So this is not just about doing videos and then posting them on Instagram or YouTube. This is live broadcasting and live interaction on the social media with those customers at that time. And it could be a customer of one, or it could be 1,000 or 100,000 customers at the same time who are saying, "Oh yeah, I've seen you make that thing, or I've seen you just show that thing, like the fashion catwalk, or a customer showing off the dress, and then bang, 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 those are purchased." And that live interaction, I think, is very applicable to the West, particularly with the high streets dying and all that's happening now.
Absolutely, and we've seen mobile solutions in the West attempt to use the store assistants to drive that sort of behavior. I think it will come. It's something that is began as very uniquely Chinese because the social reinforcement, the community aspect of shopping. I mean, on the commodity side, you've got the hyper growth of companies like Pinduoduo who allow group buying. That reinforcement is very core to China, but I think it will come here, and you're already seeing. You know, you're already seeing it. And I think the key is that WeChat made that so easily monetizable. And it incentivized that happening at scale. And that will come, no doubt. And a lot of the Western social networks have tried apps and programs embedded in them. I think there is that is something that will happen.
Yeah. But I think it goes back to your point that the Chinese have come through this, and other developing countries in that as well. So I think a lot of the stuff you're talking about is successful in China, won't succeed in the West, could succeed in India and Asia and other parts of that of the world. But I think it's that, you know, through early 2000s, when the UK went through its .com and the US went through its .com with people on PCs, the crisis there then with the .com crash, Jack Ma started with Alibaba doing business-to-business transactions because of the SARS situation in the early 2000s, Jack Ma and Alibaba took off because then they were providing the PC platform. And it's interesting now, what I think I'm seeing here is the crisis we're going through with the coronavirus. I feel the West is learning the stuff that China learnt 5-10 years ago in using mobile phones and the online and the WhatsApps and, you know, and the Zoom and whatever else we're using now. But it's really interesting, I think, in terms of China now and the people I keep in touch with China and my colleague, and that, you know, we were being stuff in the electric vehicle space and 5G space. What they're saying now in China, they are now leapfrogging us again in what they've been doing while they've been locked down for 2 months, is a lot more artificial intelligence, virtual reality, different ways of interacting with customers directly, and 5G type propositions. And I'm seeing, you know, WeChat messages with autonomous vehicles and autonomous shops just opening because now they've got the opportunity the way people are working. So I feel that the West going through this crisis are doing what Chinese did, say, 10 years ago. And the Chinese now are on a different level again. Would you see that?
I think there is definitely, look, these foundational technologies are so much more established there that you're right. We are, when it comes to what you can do with a smartphone and over, you know, fast data-enabled networks, they are ahead. To an extent, the shocking trends that we were seeing prior to coronavirus have just been, likely in its early days, have just been exacerbated by the virus. I think that there's a real need, boiling it down, there's a real need for consumers to continue consuming, but also engaging with products and service in a different way because they're stuck indoors. And the smartphone with high resolution depth sensor cameras and fast networks, that is the inevitable platform. Right. I think the West is, it's interesting your point about SARS because we are sort of seeing that here for the first time, and this is a time of great disruption. Everyone is, it's really interesting to watch what will emerge.
So we're recording this now at the end of March, and China is now starting to come out of their lockdown in a very controlled way. In the West, we're seeing the traumas in Italy, in Spain, and it's coming through the UK. But, you know, stepping back from all of that health and business sort of issues, would you see some trends that are now going to come out of this crisis regarding fashion and regarding retail and online? What sort of key things would you be seeing?
So I think that it goes back to the point that the mobile device and e-commerce will emerge stronger from this, certainly as a relative importance to in-store for the majority of different kinds of products. In fashion in particular, we still see a very strong future for the physical store. It's a very, very experiential, tactile purchase if you're buying clothes.
Yeah.
But more generally, I think this will certainly force the evolution of different kinds of mobile commerce technologies. And we've talked a little bit about AR already, I think. The day is coming when networks and edge computing, so devices themselves, have enough power to really do a good job of visualizing clothing, for example. You can try things on before you buy virtually. We're seeing a lot of development that I think will only accelerate in things like avatars and virtual products. I mean, you can look back a few years to this. You can look back at, you know, the rise of in-game purchases in Fortnite, for example,
or
the fashion collaborations with various large big-ticket games to see where that's headed. But if people have a fundamental need to express themselves, and fashion in particular is about creativity, and if people are unable to express themselves by hanging out with friends or going to dinner parties or parties, that will happen online inevitably. So I think this will grow, and you just have to look at the rise of video conferencing and the Zoom filters that are everywhere these days at this point in the coronavirus crisis. So I think the physical retail environment, as far as my industry, luxury, is concerned, will pick up and is a fixture, but the relative share of digital we expect to grow to approximately 25% by 2025. And that may be, that's a pre-coronavirus statistic. That was a Bain statistic. And so that may accelerate even further. And you're going to have to, the way e-commerce works now in the West is fundamentally the same as it was when I was running an e-commerce website in 2004 to 2007. The paradigm hasn't shifted, and I think that is way overdue. And Amazon, to an extent, has driven that established behavior. You know, it's the shopfront online with a lot of stuff, and it's getting through the site as quickly as possible, finding what you want as quickly as possible, getting checked out as quickly as possible. That is fantastic for commodity products, albeit potentially quite befuddling, and their product search is, it needs to continue improving. However, sites that are able to portray and convey a product in as rich a way as possible that appeals to the emotion and has experience around it, and then link that to the offline experience through integrations with stores or clienteling or the shop floor assistants, they are the ones that in luxury at least will succeed. You have to have the full O2O package, but the web experiences, the mobile experiences, are emerging very fast now.
I agree very much. I think this time of just flicking through images of products and stuff and expecting to click and buy, I think is just, you know, I don't sort of get it. You know, when my daughters or when friends are sort of flicking through this sort of stuff, it's about the storytelling. It's about the brand telling their story. It's about the interacting. It's, as you said, it's the, you know, it might be techie things, but it's just, you know, when you get that experience of walking into a store or meeting a designer and getting that background story is so fundamental to the part. And it doesn't need to be that techie, but it needs to be that overall experience, because that's what you said, you know, lots of stuff is happening in the store and that at the moment. And if you've got that different view of how you do that, rather than just optimizing your ads and paying lots of money to Google or Facebook to be able to get more images, is going to be the thing which isn't going to be there. That's fascinating. So David, really appreciate it. Go on. Cool.
No, sorry. Go for it, please.
No, I was just going to say, I think you've given us some really fantastic insights. Normally my last question is around, you know, what do you do when you're not working? What do you do to relax? normally, and what are you doing now you're in lockdown? Maybe need to make that a two-part question at the moment.
Well, yeah, there you go. I mean, normally I love traveling. I have privilege to do a lot of it with work, but increasingly with a young family, that's something I enjoy. Clearly, that's had to put some plans on hold. I'm a keep fit fanatic, and one of the saving graces is I managed to build a bit of a home gym in a shed in the garden, so I don't have to be bothering people on the crowded pavements during social distancing.
Right.
So that's highly fortunate. I guess working out how to keep busy at home these days, which is it's a new challenge, but not one that is. It's not too bad yet. I think if this thing lasts for 6 months, it might get problematic.
So are you homeschooling now? What's your
situation? We are. We have three children. My wife's a teacher, so she is not at school at the moment. Her school is not open for key workers.
Oh, right. So she's got a class of three instead of 30 in that at the moment. So there you go. It's all the rest of us parents who are at home trying to do the stuff that the teachers used to do, so we can sympathise now with your empathise with your wife's experiences on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, we're very lucky actually, because the arrangement is not working out too badly as things stand.
So David, thanks very much for your insights. Really appreciate your time today.
Not at all. Thank you for having me.
Please do subscribe for future podcasts. And if you like this broadcast, please give it a 5-star rating on iTunes or the platform that you listened on. Thank you.